This is the 12 Songs of Christmas, today with the Sultans of String and the Carpenters. Merry Christmas, darling. My name is Alex Frawls, and the 12 Songs of Christmas is part of my effort to understand the mixed reactions people have to Christmas music. I love it, so I'm fascinated by how it can be so hated by others. I think about Christmas music the way I think about all music, so I'm interested in the decisions that go into the recordings themselves. But I also suspect that if I only focus on the music as music, I'm missing something. Part of the point of 12 Songs is to work through some of these questions. Today, I've got two things going on. New Orleans musician Boyfriend will join me to talk about the Carpenters' Merry Christmas, Darling. But first, I'm talking to Chris McCool, violinist for the Sultans of String, the Juno Award-winning progressive string band from Canada. They're more than a decade old, and last year they released Christmas Caravan, an album of interpretations of Christmas music with an international flair. So, start at a basic place here. What are the Christmas songs that made an impression on you growing up?
Well, so growing up is kind of a funny situation. I grew up in a house with a lot of classical music in it, Middle Eastern influence due to my parents coming first and second generation from Lebanon and Egypt. Also exposed to great contemporary music, you know, prog rock from my older brother's influence and everything that was on the radio at the time. But one of the things that I always think of when I think about Christmas as a child is that we used to always have to listen to the Mario Lanza Christmas album during our Christmas dinner. That was like really the touchstone for us. When the Mario Lanza album went on, we knew it was time to rush to the dinner table and eat our Middle Eastern Arabic Christmas feast.
Oh, that's excellent. Well, by the way, what was the feast? What do you remember?
Oh, yeah. It's all the food that I can actually even cook fairly decently. Kibbeh, which is a Middle Eastern meat dish, and all the Arabic sort of maza plates that you'd imagine, like hummus and baba ganoush, tabbouleh, the little cigar rolls, which is like grape leaves with rice and spices inside, and the real kicker, my grandmother, who was living with us, would make kach, which was this incredible, delicious Arabic sweet. It's like a generations before sweet donuts, and then she'd pull this like donut-y type cookie out of this jar, just be dripping, like drenched and dripping with this like syrupy sauce. It was so good.
So Mario Lanza was the soundtrack for this dinner.
It was. I think my parents had this kind of interesting blend between listening to music from the old country as well as being real classical music listeners, and I guess that's Mario Lanza's where they found their Christmas love. Pretty syrupy versions of Christmas songs with full orchestra, and my mother being a classical pianist, I guess she really dug that vibe.
Okay, well, let's hear a little bit of that, because I have to say that I had, I knew he had recorded Christmas music, but it was absolutely not a part of my growing up. So let's find out.
Thank you.
stars are brightly shining. It is the night of the dear Savior's birth. Long lay the world in sin and sorrow pining, till he appeared and the soul felt its worth.
That is hard to imagine as dinner music.
Oh, gosh, that's even more over the top than I remembered it.
Oh, that's great.
Take me back.
That was dinner that formal? Because that sounds like that. It's hard to imagine you just sort of, you know, hunkering down to dinner. Was dinner a formal situation for you?
Well, for sure, it was definitely like family dinners were a focal point for a family. That's where everyone came together, but especially Christmas Eve, which is really the time to celebrate Christmas in Europe, and that's kind of a tradition that my parents brought over, which is great because then Christmas Day was like completely open to play with toys or hang out with friends or go to the movies or whatever crazy thing you want to do.
So how did that affect your own thoughts about Christmas music?
Well, that probably...
Christmas music,
like,
you would make, sorry.
In a way, that was probably a little bit of a turnoff. And,
sure.
And then, you know, growing up, you know, anywhere in North America, but, you know, I was living in Ottawa then, and then Montreal, and then Toronto. Like, you just hear so much Christmas music on the radio, in the mall, right after Halloween, it's like full into Christmas. And I don't know if you realize, but Canadians are more crazy about Christmas in a way than Americans. Like, I think that there's kind of a, like, for you, Thanksgiving is very substantial. And we have our Thanksgiving much earlier, which paves the way for a longer ramp up to Christmas. Like, fully 1/6 of our lives are consumed by Christmas. So I thought, you know, just listening to these songs over and over and hearing the same songs over and over on the radio and on speakers when you're in malls, was kind of driving me crazy. And then somebody, it was actually the conductor of the Edmonton Symphony Orchestra that we had a concert with him, and then we were out for dinner, and he said to us one night, he said, why, like, you guys should really have a Christmas show. You don't have a Christmas show? And I'm like, no, why would we want a Christmas show? And he said, you guys would kill it, like, with your world music rhythms, because we like to play a whole variety of rhythms. Like, in a typical show, you'll hear Arabic rhythms, Cuban rhythms, East Coast Celtic, Gypsy Jazz from Eastern Europe, Rumba Flamenca from Southern Spain. That's really what Sultans of String is all about, is just bringing all these wonderful musical influences together and creating new art with it. And I said, oh, you know, honestly, I'd never thought of it, but you know, how would that work? And then, you know, over the course of a beer, we basically sketched out the whole show on a napkin. And I got really excited about it. And then I started looking for connections between the older Christmas repertoire and our music. And I found some really fun ones. Like, there's a song called, well, people know it as Carol of the Bells, but prior to Carol of the Bells, that's the one that goes dun, 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 dun. Prior to Carol of the Bells, that song was known as The Little Swallow, also known as Shtedrik. And it's a Ukrainian New Year's carol, but it's been kind of co-opted by the whole Christmas machinery. We discovered that we had a bulerías, which is a Spanish form of music, our own Spanish bulerías song called Al Vuelo, that had the exact same kind of rhythm and gait to it. And we found that we could kind of knock back and forth between that traditional Shtedrik song and our Al Vuelo song. And that became kind of like the nugget of, okay, this is how this is going to work. We're going to take beautiful old songs, but strip them back right to the studs, like take away the last 100 years of things that people have been doing to those songs, and find our own way of combining our original music with these older songs. So that's one of the tunes we did okay. as an example.
I'm going to come back to that in just a minute, but I think when I first asked the question, it was actually kind of going to a more elemental place then. I'll tell you what I was thinking about. You know, for me, you know, I loved Christmas music as a kid, and then somewhere in like my teenage years that I you know, lost interest, largely because at that point, you know, music kind of became for me one of the ways that I, you know, like so many teenagers, it's the way you found your tribe. That the people who liked your music were, you know, were your people, and the people who didn't weren't. And music was also sort of part of the way you started to draw the line between where mom and dad ended and where you start. and so, needless to say, at that time, Christmas music was all, in my mind, kind of mom and dad music. And so, and rock and roll was my music. And it wasn't until I started to hear things, particularly, because it stands out for me, there was, I think, in 81 or 82, Z Records in New York released the Z Christmas album, and on it, it had August Darnell from Kid Creole and the Coconuts released a track, recorded track, Christmas on Riverside Drive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it's a kind of, and it's a, you know, a dance, sort of dance rock track, you know, heavily, you know, disco-ish, and very much sort of a New York club song. And at that moment, I heard sort of my musical values reflected in Christmas music, and I could find my connection. And I guess that's kind of where it started when we started talking about Mario Lanza and kind of what, you know, you kind of took it away I kind of expected, and that was sort of what you didn't want to do. But I guess sort of the other side of it was part of like starting to, you know, was the next sort of the next task to figure out how to make Christmas music that did reflect your values.
Absolutely, and I think that one of the like the architecture of this band is the exploring the world music rhythms and trying to find what's inherently beautiful about the classic Christmas songs, like looking for those nuggets and then bringing them out so that people can hear those Christmas songs in a fresh way, but a way sometimes that is either like maybe closer to how I think they were originally conceived, or else turning a song completely on its head and showing it in just a zany, fresh way that no one's ever thought of before, just to kind of like, I guess, like a slap, in the face, like, wake up, here's another way of hearing the song. But also, you know, you talk about that moment when you're evolving into a teenager and you're separating yourself from your parents and generation and finding your tribe with your friends. For me, musically, that was some of the great Canadian folk singer-songwriters. And a song that we did not record, but that I always think of around that time of year is River by Joni Mitchell, which is such a gorgeous song and really timeless and simple and stripped down. And I think that we found an opportunity with another song, which actually is not a Christmas song at all, but Hallelujah by Leonard Cohen, that we tried to treat in a new way. Or Silent Night, that I think with Silent Night, we actually, in my head, I was trying to capture the timeless feel of that Joni Mitchell track in an instrumental Christmas tune, you know, just finding creating a space where you could just kind of lose yourself in the silence and the space that you might find on a crisp winter morning when everyone is still asleep and maybe it's twilight and the sun hasn't quite come up yet.
Let's go to hear a track. I think my favorite on Christmas Caravan, and certainly I think the most surprising, is Turkish Greensleeves. And so let's hear a moment of that, and then we can talk about how that fits into this conversation. Thank you. So what's the story behind that version?
This is one of the tracks that I'm the most proud of on the record, and why we put it first, because what I think that it really is a perfect example of taking something ancient and making it contemporary while also honoring sort of the world music vibe that we like to go for. The opening violins you heard are from these Turkish Roma violin players in Istanbul. And I met them through a musical colleague in Toronto. When I heard them play, I just thought, like, I was just so amazed at the sound that they could create, which sounds like nothing else on the planet. This is kind of like an extended family. The group is called Gundam Yeli Grubu, and they're an extended family that bring together these string players that learn from a very, very young age. They learn to play the violin, you know, sometimes on the streets of Istanbul with their older brothers and parents and cousins, and so they really gel with an incredible vibe. And that song, you know, started off, well, that song has many forms. It's called Green Sleeves, it's called What Child Is This, with more Christmas-y Christian lyrics. It's been used many ways, but I thought that was a neat way of sort of digging back into the repertoire and bringing something new forward.
When you're trying to obviously create a world music version, I mean, of all these songs, and obviously that's central to your band's identity, but I also wonder to what extent the world you live in, specifically Southern Ontario, how that plays into it, and how the fact is that Toronto is such an international city and such a multicultural city, and how Southern Ontario is so multicultural. How does that factor, that reality factor into your thoughts about the music you should be making?
You know, that's a really good question, because there is something that happens in Toronto and Southern Ontario. This album is very much a product of the environment that we live in here, because we have a very, very international community in Toronto. I think for the first time last year, we hit a percentage of more than 50% of people in Toronto are recent or new immigrants from places around the world. And with them, they bring their music. And so Toronto is a real meeting place of music from around the world. And in any typical band, you might have people with many different backgrounds, you know, like just like we have a couple of wonderful Cuban percussionists that are in our band that bring that whole world of percussion into the mix, and all the incredible musicians we can collaborate here with, like that are from across continents, you know, they're from Africa and South America and South Asia, and that all informs what we're able to do. In fact, it's almost harder to keep things, you know, sort of simple and more pure. You know, even a Celtic band in Toronto is going to have maybe a djembe playing in their band, and you know, so it's a really great place to learn from each other and celebrate each other's musics and figure out how to incorporate it all.
Yeah, I used to live in Toronto. I used to live upstairs from a Korean grocery, and I worked in a Portuguese neighborhood, and used to drink in an Italian neighborhood. Used to drink at a cafe that Bruce Coburn, in the summertime,
oh, yeah.
would be sitting at the same. On the same patio. He was sort of sitting by himself in the corner with notebooks. And anyway, so I that was funny that I was thinking on the record that Coots Paradise Reel, that actually sort of an East Coast, you know, an East Coast fiddle tune, was in some ways felt the most alien, or the most, you know, sort of the most unlikely, because all the rest of those rhythms I remember far more clearly hearing, whether intentionally or just ambiently, while living in Toronto.
Well, that's a Coots Paradise Reel is a fiddle tune that I wrote because I thought it'd be really fun to marry a fiddle tune with a French tune, Les Anges dans nos campagnes, which is a song that we had Benoît Bourque sing in. And if your listeners are interested at all in Québécois music, music from Quebec here in Canada, check out a band called La Bottine Souriante, which translates to the smiling boot. It's a traditional Quebecois band that has, you know, so they play lots of string, rootsy kind of instruments, but then they bring in horns, a whole horn section and drums, and it's really one of the best, might be my favorite festival dancing band ever. So it was a real treat to get Benoît, the lead singer, to come and help us with that track.
So I think the most conventional song on A Christmas Caravan is your version of John Lennon and Yoko Ono's Happy Christmas, War is Over. So let's hear a little bit of that, and then we'll come back to talk about that.
So this is Christmas, and what have you done? Another year over, and a new one's just begun.
So who are the voices that we're hearing on that track?
So Ruben Blades and Luba Mason were singing on that version of Happy Christmas, War is Over. Ruben is a real superstar in Panama. In fact, I think he's even run for president there. And his wife is a fantastic singer, Luba. And what we wanted to do something kind of different with that song, so we opened up the beginning of it with a kind of a new stretchy feely time signature, but then it goes into more of a Spanish feel after the chorus there, and Ruben starts singing in Spanish, and it's so lovely because we chose him as kind of the perfect guy to sing the Spanish lyrics because he's really an activist. He's somebody who's really worked towards peace and bringing people together over the last couple of decades. And they're gorgeous lyrics. En Navidad es todo es amor, paz y alegría sin excepción. Treat to make that. And then we brought the whole shebang to Prague and had the Prague Philharmonic Orchestra lay some strings on it, which sounded really cool. They're an orchestra that's done a lot of movie soundtracks, so they were able to play this stuff, most of the stuff, like the first time through and sound really amazing at it.
Oh, that's great. So what, when you think about a song like that, like such a familiar song, and a song where, while you're, there are very clear, distinct musical choices you're making that are changing the song. Nobody's having any mysteries about what is that. Everybody knows what they're hearing. So what has to stay in the song, in your mind, for Happy Christmas, War is Over to work?
That's a good question. You know, sometimes we get carried away, too, with a bunch of us in the band being from the jazz background of making something a little bit too different. But, you know, sometimes the game that the jazz musicians play is how far can I take this song outside of what it really, how it started, like what's the nugget of the song? How far can you take it away from that and it still be the song, still be recognizable? For me, the sort of chanting at the end, "War is over if you want it. War is over now," and kind of like the "We are the world" coming together, like a million people singing, is what really nails it.
Actually, I was going to say, for me, that's that build, the idea of going from the very small, personal, one person, to building up to the whole sort of everybody, let's kumbaya this, the hell out of this moment. And yeah.
It's like the Beatles' Hey Jude. You know, you start with a single voice and guitar, and you build up to a gigantic orchestra and choir.
Yeah, and I think because... as much as, you know, and I think, you know, although obviously, you know, and we've been at war now for more than a decade, but we don't think about, but war isn't present in our consciousness the same way it was in, was, I think that's what, 1970 or so? I should have looked that up, but Happy Christmas was, you know, was early 70s, and mm-hmm. Vietnam War was so present in people's minds. And in a way that it seems to me like you, that now that kind of big hippie moment, feel, you know, it kind of needs to sound hippie so that war is over. If you want it, doesn't sound landlocked in the 70s. And anyway, that's where I come. That's how I, you know, where, you know, I always feel like that's a crucial thing that we do play with. The context that it originally appeared in, even though we are making the very legitimate observation that war still could be over, and the fact is we're still in it.
I think it's really easy as we go about our lives to forget about how much war there actually is right now on Earth and how implicated we are. Like, war has changed so much, you know, moving to drone strikes instead of boots on the ground. There is much, much less North American lives lost in war, but the impact around the globe is just as huge, and the importance of creating peace is just as important. So, for me, including that song is just like a reminder and a moment when we perform live to bring it back to the audience a little bit.
Do you remember your feelings about that song when you first heard it?
Well, I was 2 years old, so
okay.
when it was first released. But I do remember when I was a teenager and I was cluing in to the Beatles. And yeah, it's an incredible song, and you know, any song that can stand the test of time like that, any song that's been around for 50 years, there is usually something in it which is really great. And there's kind of an honestness in that song, in the way that song is written and the way it was originally performed. There was an honestness that I think really grabbed people and made it a classic.
Yeah, I'll tell you what I was thinking about, that's always seemed important about the song for me, was that as far as I can't think of another song that kind of was the kind of counterculture Christmas song. Because on one hand, the, you know, the sort of, in a lot of ways, the counterculture was, you know, grew and developed in opposition to the world that was sort of typified by classic Christmas songs, by the Christmas canon that we hear it, you know, in the malls, etc. And so to have, you know, and for them, and after the Beatle invasion, that, you know, Christmas songs really became a less prominent thing, and that you, and certainly for teenagers, for people who were Beatle fans, Stones fans, this wasn't a part of, you know, a part of their young life to have the musicians they liked making Christmas music. And so to have, like, somebody whose rock and roll bona fides were as solid as John Lennon to have him making one that also is essentially is part of a hippie moment and is part of a, you know, a bed-in or a chant-in or a sing-in or whatever. It's like, that's, it was just kind of had all the sort of the rock and roll counterculture stamp of approval. And like, and it, so, you know, I think it was for a long time the rock and roll Christmas song.
Yeah, and could become a rallying cry for those around the world. Like one of the, if you check out our video of that on YouTube, we'll see that we visited the John Lennon Wall in Prague, and it used to be just a normal wall, but since the 80s, it's been filled with John Lennon inspired graffiti and pieces of lyrics from Beatles songs, and it was a real source of irritation for the communist regime at the time, led to a clash between students and security police, and so it's provided that kernel of of irritation that could be rallied around.
Oh, that's great. Well, let's hear a little bit of the John and Yoko version. And this is Happy Christmas, War is Over.
Happy Christmas, Yoko.
Happy Christmas, Johnny.
So this is Christmas. And what have you done? Another year over. And you won't just be gone. And so this is Christmas.
Was I hearing a mandolin in there? Are you hearing a mandolin?
I don't know if I heard a mandolin. For sure, I heard the the really loud tambourine. And I heard an interview the other day on the radio. It was a Canadian guy who, during the filming, I think he said that he was like side stage or jumped on stage or something, and just started playing the tambourine, and he cut kind of like an eyeball look from the band, like, okay, that's a little bit on the loud side, but do you hear how loud that is in the mix? That's amazing. It's a little bit like the cowbell of the cowbell of the 70s or something.
Exactly.
So, more tambourine.
Exactly. Well, Chris, thanks for joining me. Sultans of String will be on tour for most of the rest of the year, and they will play Christmas Caravan shows starting in the last week of November. You can find dates at sultansofstring.com. So I'm joined today by my friend Boyfriend, New Orleans founder of Rap Cabaret.
Hello, hello.
And today we are going to talk about the Carpenters' "Merry Christmas, Darling" at your suggestion.
Ah,
why?
Yes. Well, I love a woman singing a sad song. First of all my favorite songs are usually these just simple, slow love songs. But I think specifically for this one and for all Christmas music, it's a sentimentality thing more than a musicianship. So I couldn't tell you about the key it's in or the instrumentation. It's the fact that my mom listened to it on vinyl growing up and then had it on rotation every Christmas when I was growing up. And then when Amy Grant covered it, she actually released it as a bonus track, and you could only get it through Target. And I remember one of my aunts had bought hers at like Barnes & Noble, and it didn't have the bonus track. And to this day, it is a sore point in the family that she doesn't have the hidden track by Amy Grant. But yeah, this song is just a great one in my family. I think, there's a lot of women in my family, and we're all in touch with our sensitive side, and we're well acquainted with heartbreak.
All right. Let's hear a little bit to start, and then we'll come back for more.
Greeting cards have all been sent. The Christmas rushes through, but I still have one wish to make, a special one for you. Merry Christmas, darling. We're apart, that's true, but I
chills. I really do.
There's so much in that to unpack. First, Christmasing.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, the same thing. To make a verb of that is pretty brilliant.
Oh, and actually, they return to it a number of times. Yeah. I think that's in the chorus each time, so that makes me so happy. The other thing I think is really interesting, I find that so profoundly sad.
Yeah,
but I always find Karen Carpenter's voice profoundly sad.
Yeah.
As you know, as technically remarkable as a singer as she is, and as gorgeous a voice as she has, I always have in my mind sort of a, you know, sort of sad librarian, mm-hmm. and who's got this entire inner world, none of which, all of which she's waiting for. She's like so close to having this world. She's looking at this world, and she's, you know, in this case, this is like a classic Christmas song in that, in the end, she's like, I wish I were with you. It still goes back to like the classic Christmas songs, like White Christmas, where it's like, in the end, she's not there. She's, you know, she loves Christmas, and she wants to have Christmas with him.
Wah, wah.
But she can't.
Yeah. Well, I love... I don't know how much of it is the hindsight of knowing, you know, her tragic fate, that I apply that sort of sadness to her voice. But I think that there's deep sadness in anything that's really good. Like any really good art has to have this dark undercurrent of sadness, even if it's off in the distance, like the movie Superbad or something. You know, like even if it's as silly as it is, I feel like there's got to be darkness in play, or it's going to fall flat. And so for her, even if she's singing a happy love song, there's something so heartbreaking about it. And maybe that was her talent, was her ability to kind of imbibe that silence, or that, that somber sadness, mm-hmm. even if the message is more happy, even if it's a Christmas song.
Sure. You know, part of my, you know, I have the same response to her story. I always try to wonder, to what extent the nature of her death affects the way I feel about her voice and the way I feel about her songs. But I had the same issue, and I think I always had the same issue, like in a song like Superstar. I always found that to be such an eccentric choice for them to do, because it was always so hard to imagine that she was the groupie who, you know, had a night with the rock star, and then spending the rest of her time pining, and you remember you told me you love me? That part's incredibly easy to remember.
Yeah.
But it's the first half of that I always found to be a reach. And kind of a result, I've always heard Carpenter's kind of as sound, and it's only really been in the last handful of years that I've actually stopped and to think about how the words and sound connect.
Mm-hmm.
I guess at the same time, like I think about it, for my case, the Carpenters came up. The Carpenters started at a time, you know, when I'm sort of finding my, you know, I'm like teenager and I'm deciding, like, you know, who are my people in the world, and you know, my people play electric guitars, and you know, just the utter just nothing but sweetness of Carpenters and the arrangements of Richard all seemed to me, this is not my world.
Well, it's like from the past.
Sure.
I mean, literally.
actually, that's
like there, it's in the 70s, but it sounds like it could be the 50s or 40s.
Sure.
If you take it from an an arrangement approach and the orchestration and all of that. Like, we were past that by then.
Right.
And that's part of what I love about them, is that they're like these relentless sentimentalists.
Yes. And it's something that, as time passed, I've now come to love a whole lot more. And I actually was thinking, you know, how many kind of sort of cool and really beautiful moves there are in that. And once they get out of the introduction and into the verse, it feels like the whole song slows down. It feels like there's a moment where it starts to just drag just a touch as it settles into Merry Christmas, Darling. And that movement strikes me as really musically sort of cool and really complicated, you know, maybe. Since I don't know how to do it, it seems like it must be complicated. But it also really it moves from this really sort of pretty introduction to a much more sort of genuine and a much more sort of precise feeling, Merry Christmas, Darling. And you realize that is the extent of that thought. It's not in that moment an undercurrent or anything else. Other lyrics may carry more meaning, but there is that core of, here's the simple and single thing she really most wants to say. Mm-hmm. And I thought in retrospect, that matched with that movement, that musical movement, is like really kind of powerful.
I totally hear that. I also love that it's set at the end of it all, and I think it's a little ahead of its time in two ways, even as it's reaching back. For one thing, Christmasing is, like, we make verbs of things now. It's a very meme culture type thing.
Right.
And I don't think that they were necessarily pre-meme, but there's something about that feels, I don't know, a little maybe tongue-in-cheek, even as serious as they seem to approach sentimentality. And then I think, like, explicitly articulating the Christmas rush and the fact that Christmas is actually kind of stressful. You know, the greeting cards have all been sent, the Christmas rush is through. It's just these two lines,
right.
But it just sets you in, like, this sort of, to me, modern state of mind where we are rushed and it is a kind of hectic time for people. To kind of put that out there and then move on to this message, I don't know, I'm right there with it. It speaks to me as a 21st century woman.
Right. Well, the one thing about the lyrics that is interesting is that they actually one of Richard's music teachers wrote the words.
Oh.
That it started that it it's 1970 and Richard had started thinking about a Christmas album and he started to put together music, but he didn't have any lyrics. And he actually talked to one of his teachers who it turned out actually had written this lyric as a poem for a girlfriend.
Oh, that's I remember this now. Yeah.
And
from years earlier.
That's right. Yeah. And so initially they recorded it as a single. I did homework. I had to check this stuff, but it first came out in 1970 with no album attached to it. And it came out that Christmas and topped the charts and did so, top the holiday charts, 70, 71, and 72. I love this, the durability of Christmas mm-hmm. music. And it was released again in 73, again in 77, and then in 78 they released Christmas Portrait, the Carpenters' Christmas album.
Tour de force.
And they re-recorded it for that.
Ah, okay, so that's a different.
It's a different version, and that's the version they did a Carpenter's Christmas special that year. And so if you go on YouTube and you see her walk, see Karen like in his old timey house.
Yeah. I love it.
Yes. And, but that's a slightly different arrangement because it was, you know, that was re-recorded in 78. So
that's some real durability there.
Yeah.
From lyrics from the 60s.
Right.
Released in the 1970 at the change of everything and then re-released when everything's about to change again.
Well, and in retrospect, you know, if you think about this, that it was the right moment because in 1970, you would have, on one hand, the holdover of sort of beautiful music mm-hmm. and sort of the hi-fi, and you had a world where, you know, Burt Bacharach, you know, still had incredible, you know, cultural cachet as the, you know, sort of the harbinger of one kind of world. Versus, you know, a sort of a counter, the growth of a counterculture, and in many ways, the commercialization of a counterculture. And you have Carpenters kind of living on this line. And like you know, that makes sense. And of course, they would make a Christmas record to occupy that space, and because it was such a tradition in sort of the beautiful music, beautiful music sort of world. But doing it with long hair, doing it with doing it with crazy bangs and bell bottoms. And that is still ultimately like locates itself in the moment, but then also touches back into sort of, deeply traditional thoughts, like longing. So, there's a beautiful Christmas to be had. I'm just not having it. So, anyway, yeah. Well, thank you for that. And we'll move on to more stuff.
Indeed.
Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas, darling.
I'll link to Boyfriend's SoundCloud page where you can hear her music, including a recent cover of I'm Gonna Wash That Man Right Out of My Hair. Thanks to Boyfriend and Chris McCool for being a part of today's show. Our theme music is Dawn of the Cosmos by Ask Again. You can find 12 Songs of Christmas on Facebook, so drop by and say hi. If you have history with John and Yoko's Happy Christmas War is Over, or The Carpenters at Christmas Time, stop by and share. If Mario Lanza is part of your Christmas history, I'm interested in hearing more about it because he was not part of mine. Thanks for dropping by, and if you have a chance, please tell your friends about us. Everybody needs to know about One More Podcast. We'll see you next week.